This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
August Wilson is, without a doubt, the greatest black playwright of all time, one of the greatest of all time, regardless. What makes August, what makes that work so great and so important and so lasting?
August Wilson took African-American life and made it theater, which we are theatrical, wonderfully evolving, wonderfully versatile people because we're living the multiplicity of worlds and lives. So we have had to have what my mother called mother wit to survive. That's thinking on your feet real fast. So white people may call it common sense. But we had to have common sense of when to say things and do things that could cause our not only survival in life, but advancement.
Ruben Santiago Hudson is an amazing actor and director who was a friend of August Wilson's. He acted in August's plays. He has directed them. He has read them. He has opined and thought deeply on the meaning, the Augustness of August Wilson, the greatest black playwright ever. August plays are so dope. I wanted to talk to Ruben about August's work on the occasion of August's play, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, becoming a film on Netflix. So here we go. You'll get half of this conversation here. For the other half, for the whole thing, go to patreon.com/Touré Show. Here we go. It's Ruben Santiago Hudson on the work of the great August Wilson on Touré Show. So I want to talk about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in general. But before we get into the whole of it, let's just talk about Chadwick and what he does in this project. And I haven't gotten to see it yet. So please help the folks understand, you know, what it's like working with him on set and what he's like just in terms of making the production in general.
Well, you know, as the writer, rarely are we on set. I was not on set.
Okay.
I do know Chad. We've had, matter of fact, I've revisited a lot of our text messages prior to Ma Rainey, because I did bring him into New York to when I recorded the 10 August Wilson plays for the American Century Cycle at the Green Space under producer Indira Etwaru. I brought him in to do Citizen and Gem of the Ocean with Felicia Rashad. And even prior to that, we had communicated, and he had come to rehearsals of plays I had done. And it's rare in life, not just in the arts, to come across a young man that has such majesty. He just carried himself in a way that was uncanny. You know, it was like, wow, I mean, so early, you understand exactly who you are and what your responsibilities are, not only to your career, but to your village, to the people that matter to you, the people that built you, the people who are a part of the fabric of who you are. So Chad carried himself in a very unusual way. I say unusual in the fact that he was purely and definitively established in what was important to him. And so I know that much about Chad and worked with him in that respect. As far as the movie, I witnessed it from afar as the writer. A lot of times the writer is not invited on the set because the authority there is the director, producer, and sometimes they feel a little uncomfortable. with the writer there when words start getting changed and things. But in this particular case, since I am very close to August Wilson, was very close to August Wilson, who wrote three roles for me, who I've directed his work, I've co-starred in his work, I've written his work into screenplays, probably the only living person in the world, or live or dead, that has acted, directed, and adapted his work. And I'm certain I'm the only person in, who've done it. So that could be a little intimidating if somebody wants to take their path. Like George is an extraordinary director.
George Wolfe.
And he clearly is in charge on set. And me being there might give the actors, you know, Rube, what do you think about, you know, and I'm sure they didn't want that round, because I consider myself more than an authority on August Wilson's work, but somebody intimately entwined and involved in his work. So it's you know, then, you know.
what was Chadwick like as a person?
He was very inquisitive. From what I mean, we weren't like, that wasn't like my run buddy, but he was somebody who I had extraordinary respect for. And he likewise showed it to me. And I didn't think he knew me. And he actually wrote in a paper about witnessing me rehearse, witnessing Felicia Rashad, witnessing Anthony Chisholm, the people who were in Gem of the Ocean. He came and sat in the dark and watched us rehearse at the theater. But upon meeting him, you know, he seemed to be eager to meet us all, but he gave us all our space and our time. He was quiet, he was introspective, and he kind of like absorbed. But around him, if he was here today, I would say the same thing. If we were on this together, he carried an aura that of way more than eagerness and wanting to know. It was more like absorption. It was like, I know who I am. I know what my responsibility is to people of African descent. I know what my responsibility is to the African diaspora and the journey we've had in this country. He just carried it, and you knew it. And so it made you want to embrace him immediately. And then all you have to do is, if you really want to know what a person is, look at his track record, look at the people who he affected, who were around him. And Chadwick always, you know, he had extraordinary integrity. I'll put it that way.
So, okay, let's talk about August Wilson and then move into Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. August Wilson is, without a doubt, the greatest black playwright of all time, one of the greatest of all time, regardless. I've seen a lot of his work. I've read about him. I've read the work. But you are the foremost expert. So help us understand what makes August, what makes that work so great and so important and so lasting.
Well, you know, when you say I'm the foremost, that will cause a lot of controversy, because a lot of people claim that or think that, you know, so a lot of people have ownership of the knowledge of August's work in tremendous depth. I know what I've achieved in our relationship, and I just hold that precious. But the thing is this, August Wilson took African-American life and made it theater, which we are theatrical, wonderfully evolving, wonderfully versatile people, because we're living the multiplicity of worlds and lives. So we have had to have what my mother called mother wit to survive. That's thinking on your feet real fast. So white people may call it common sense. But we had to have common sense of when to say things and do things that could cause our not only survival in life, but advancement. So we have to walk those lives. August would take and show our private aspect. He would take us in our arenas where we long to speak and behold. Backyards, bars, restaurants, recording studios. Notice the duplicity. The recording studio basement conversation is completely different than the recording studio recording area, because white people are present. So how do you present yourself? What is your persona then? About when they go down the basement, they like talking all, look at your shoes. And they, yeah, you don't know that about their music. But they're not saying all that in front of the white man. They're paying respect to each other to a certain degree. They're musicians. So August took all of this incredible.
He elevates us, but he's also sharply authentic and right on it.
Just the way he heard it. And this is where I get in conflict with some of the so-called August Wilson scholars who don't know and have not lived their lives surrounded by Northern colored people. And I use that term as a term that I coined because these were Southern colored people who migrated North and they stayed colored. The only thing changed was the location.
What do you mean? Why do you say colored instead of black or Negro or?
In those days, they were colored in the 30s, you know, and you know, nobody wanted to be Negro. You was colored and you came North, you stay colored. When I say that, it was the way you cooked, the way you danced, the way you courted, the way you solved your arguments and your disputes, the way you dressed, your style. You was Northern colored now. You weren't Southern colored. So it's evolution. So August took the way he heard things. As I was saying, I get in these debates sometimes with people who don't know Northern colored people. And they'd be like, well, how did August make up that? He got arrested for worthlessness. And I'm like, we got arrested for uselessness, worthlessness, senselessness. You know, you look dangerous. Well, how else can I look in any way but the way I look? You know what I'm saying? That's how I look. So August elevated our regular lives to theater. The brilliance of August is that he took what we take as commonplace life and he made it perfect, incredible theater. So it could be, the net could be cast so wide that other people get to experience the essence of who we are, as Elaine Locke would say, the essence of this new Negro, which is the Harlem Renaissance. But August, everything he did was new to people who didn't know us.
And for folks who don't know, his body of work represents the decades of the 20th century. Is that right?
That's why we call it the American Century Cycle, because it was the 20th century, decade by decade, a play set in each decade, not a play about the decade, but set in each decade. And it shows you how much things have changed and how much things stayed the same. The injustices, they never changed. It was just a different way to do them. We found ourselves struggling and fighting for truth, justice, equality, parity, in each play, nobility. We fought the same battles each decade, and we're fighting it today. The same things we're fighting for.
And yet there is a cultural growth throughout them, right?
Yes, absolutely, because when we begin to recognize as a people who we are and our strength, our contributions, our beauty, you know, we begin to as Zora Neale Hurston would say, gleam it around and let it shine. So we got bigger because we were fighting for our freedom and equality. So we got louder. In the 60s, we got real loud. In the 70s, we got loud. And we had been quiet for a long time. Now we're loud again. August would love this time, you know?
Yes, that's right. That's right. There was a quiet in the 80s and 90s as we were getting a little more economic power and the street fight for political power. And I think the rise of drugs quieted us, the rise of incarceration quieted us to a certain extent. But the last, 5-10 years, we have been politically very loud.
And you know what has happened since we got loud again? You know, when we get loud in any conversation and we're the only black person in the room, whether you're talking about it, are the Lakers going to beat Miami? And we get, you know, people say we got angry.
Right.
So we are always concerned in white spaces how we are perceived. But today we're not because we want to be loud. Mm-hmm. We want to say who we are, why we are, what we are, and what we're going to get. We don't say, you know what you have to do? We say, this is what we're doing. We're taking this.
When I was growing up, it meant so much to hear black voices like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison talk about the black experience, because black stories matter. The next generation of influential black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear
stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today. From The Wire to Bobby Shmurda, from Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range on Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives have not usually been centered in the telling of American stories. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Turn on NPR today and hear real Black stories, because stories should never be told about us without us being in them. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Life doesn't happen in bi-weekly segments, so why should your paycheck? The money you earn every day can be in your hands today with Earn In. Earn In is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 a day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earn In app, verify your paycheck, and then you can access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips automatically repaid from your next paycheck. So if you need to make a repair suddenly, to get a new dress or a new shirt or shoes, you can do that. You can get the money that you've already earned but haven't been paid. You can get that now with Earn In. Make Earn In a part of your financial routine and join their 3.5 million customers who say things like, when I think about Earn In, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me peace of mind. It gives you the ability to access your money now. So download Earn In today. That's E-A-R-N-I-N in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earn In app, type Torre Show under podcast when you sign up, and it'll really help us. Torre Show under podcast. Earn In is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I'm Danielle Moody.
I'm Toure.
Be sure to check out Democracy-ish, where we channeled the frustration, rage, and absurdity that was the 2020 election, as well as discuss the current state of the political climate and our country from a Black perspective.
New episodes available every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you stream your podcasts.
You know, the sense of what you're saying is very much something that I have gleaned from the past, let's say, 4, 5, 6 months, in that I think before I was definitely like, you know, how do I be unapologetically Black? But then it went forward even to like, I really don't care if I'm making you uncomfortable, white person. This is my authentic self. This is what I'm thinking about. So I'm going to say that. I'm going to introduce that. And before I would have said, hey, you know, not that I'm afraid, but there's no need to make the white people uncomfortable. Let's have a nice conversation. But now it's like, I really don't care.
Right. Because, you know, because being labeled as angry, being labeled as belligerent, being labeled as militant, or they start adding other labels that don't necessarily apply wholly, like racist, life's too short to work with him. And we are protecting the longevity of our success as well in protecting our livelihoods and our families. So we have to be careful. But now it's because white people are listening now. So you better say it, because this is going to pass. Because people spend so much time spanking white people. What white people do is figure out how to get thicker pants. so they don't feel it so hard. And then they go back to what they were doing. What we have to be careful about is that we don't use all our energy straightening them out, that we use an equal amount of more energy building our own stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what I preach. And that's what, it's scary because I'm consulting a lot of different theaters right now. And I'll be straight honest with them. And they said, well, everybody's beating me down. They should be beating you down. They should be whooping your ass. But I tell you what, you can change what's happening tomorrow so they don't keep whooping your ass. And this is what I don't want you hiring black people. I want you putting black people in positions, training them and teaching them where all your other bodies are buried, where you got your money from, how you got it, how to write grants, how to run theaters. So don't hire a director. Don't ask me what director you should hire. Find out what administrator you should have, what artistic director, what marketing director, what a stage manager, what people in control who are making decisions. You know, we're easy to grab the low-hanging fruit and say, oh, they're going to give me a directing job. It's what they did in the 80s and the late 70s is they bought or destroyed our leaders. Once they identify you, they know that the thing that black people, and I'm getting on a whole different thing. I don't want to waste your time. But they know the thing that we wake up with usually in our families are born with is trying to figure out how to get money, how to have a better life. Most white people are born with something. So they figure out how to manage money. So how to manage the house my mother left me, how to manage the $1 million that was left, how to manage the $30,000 that was left.
Hey,
Very few black people have that when they wake up.
Well, one of the big things is that we can't, very few of us can turn to a close family member when a rainy day comes and say, hey, I need your help getting out of this problem, you know, to fix the roof or what have you. Many, many white people have that family member, that parent, sister, brother, uncle who they could turn to. Hey, I need some money. I'm drowning here. So when a rainy day comes for us, it gets even rainier.
Or they have something to leverage. They have the two houses or the rental property that their parent had. And I'm not talking about wealthy white people. I'm talking just from the Homestead Act, from the first Homestead Act on forward, they made sure white people had something. Mm-hmm. So they know. The powers that be know that we're looking to get money. And so they always try to find your price. And the most dangerous person in the world of color is the one that certain things don't have a price. And that's integrity. And so when I said that in an interview in the New York Times in 1995, it made me a dangerous man. Cornel West actually spoke on it in a lecture one time at Princeton. This man said in the paper, there's no price to his integrity. And they have challenged that. People have come with prices that people say, well, shoot, I'd have took their money. And it's like, well, not for my integrity, because I got to wake up in the morning. And the only thing I really have is this face, this heart, and this who I am.
You remind me of the August Wilson New Yorker profile that was brilliant. And I remember reading it two or three times, and it was controversial because he was unapologetic and aggressive. And I think basically saying, you know, I don't really care if white people come to my plays. They are not the judges. You know, we are the judges of whether or not I am successful. Just let's talk about him as a person, as a man. Who was he?
August Wilson, you know, it's hard because you talk to 50 people and we have 50 different things to say because he was very reserved. And when he started talking, it didn't stop. I'm literally, and this is the honest to God truth, I have sat with August for 9 hours. 9 straight hours, had breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the same restaurant, same cafe. He'd just keep going out to smoke, and then he'd come back, and be back. You know, and he would just, but it seemed like he was not approachable. But once you walked up to him, and I guarantee you, if you interview 20 people that really knew August, they say the same thing. I saw him and I was scared. And I went and said, Mr. Wilson, I'm an actor too. And he said, yeah, you're going to be great. You're going to be good. Well, what do you like to act in? And he'll go. And so once he opened up, it was the trust factor. Once he felt a little trust, he wanted to impart something on you that made you leave bigger than when you met him. And for me, because people used to always think he was going to fire me because I always spoke truth to him, you know? Other actors would say, he firing you. I said, well, if he fired me, then I got to go paint a wall or drive a truck. But I just spoke, and he respected that about me. And I cannot tell you how many times people told me he would fire me because he would say something to me and I would say, I don't know. Particularly, not just about life, but about my character. If he say, he should do this. And I would say, okay, I'll try it, but I don't know if that's, he would do that. Why wouldn't he do it? That's what I think he'd do. I said, he wouldn't do it because of this that you wrote. And we would debate. But he, I think that part of me he admired. And because we both learned all our lessons and our heroes were the same people, preacher, the numbers man, the guy, the short order cook, the dishwasher, the wino, you know, these people that inhabited our communities that outside people look past, that we embraced because they sat down and wanted to get, Doc, let me tell you something. What you need to be doing, you need to be going to college, because I wanted to go work in a steel plant because I'm from Lackawanna, but I spent all my summers in Pittsburgh. August is from Pittsburgh. Same thing, all steel plants. So when we would talk, when he first heard me audition, he wrote down same language I have, same song. He showed that to me 4 years later when he finally hired me. Yeah, let me show you something. He pulls out a pad. He said, look at it. And he's looking at it. And the first thing I saw was my name. I said, man, you misspelled my name. Ain't no E in my name. I ain't talking about that. Look at this. And it said, same music I have, same song. From the audition that I didn't get. He remembered that my cadence, my style, the way I do 2-3 sentences before I stop. I'm not monosyllabic. You know, that it was the way I told my stories was similar to him. And we bonded. But he had a very short temper, particularly if it was about disrespect. If he felt disrespected, he'd be willing to die. That's August Wilson. But yet, if you need, like, there was a dude, dig this, I'm going to wrap that part up by saying this. There's a dude, when August lived in St. Paul, when August was washing dishes or something, I think it was St. Paul. It's a white guy that was washing dishes with him. Or either August was a short order cook. They worked together back. He came to every opening night. August flew him in. Look, you think he was a hobo. He had long hair, but he would have one of August, like a fences jacket or some kind of jacket. And I was saying, who's the white dude? Look like a bum. Well, he worked with August when August was a dishwasher. He flew him in every opening. So I got to know him. What's up, man? You know, so that's the kind of compassion and care, you know, that August, he just carried it, you know?
Mm. So, okay, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is the new piece coming on Netflix, the new film. Explain to us what's special about this one and what this one is about, how it fits into the canon, and what you had to do to take it from the stage to the screen.
Well, first of all, what's very special about it is for me personally, it was the first August Wilson play I saw in 1984 at the Court Theater in New York on Broadway. And it was the first time in my career, my professional career in 1984, I mean, I had already been in the business for a while, that I saw people who I felt that I knew how they smelled. I knew what their breath smelled like. I knew what they wore. I could tell the fabric of their clothes. And I snuck into the theater. I was sitting in a double mezzanine way up top on the steps. I was that far away. And when they started speaking, I only got to the second act because I snuck in the second act. When people go out to intermission and come back in, I grabbed the program, went in. I couldn't afford it. So I went in, went way up so I could hide. And I'm watching. And they started speaking. And my jaw dropped. And I sat there and watched it. I said, man, I know them. That's the people I was raised with in Nanny's Rooming House.
Same music as me?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden I felt something on my cheek and I did like this. I thought it was a fly. It was tears. I cried. And I wrote him a letter on a napkin or the back of something and left it there. And I never heard from him for years until I finally tracked him down. I wrote he and Lloyd, many notes. And I finally tracked him down in L.A. when I was moving forward on my career, you know, in the 90s when they were doing Two Trains Running. But that's what makes it extremely special to me. Also, this was the only play not set in Pittsburgh, set in Chicago. It was the play that finally Lloyd Richards, who not only mentored me and a host of other people, including Rock Dutton, Delroy Lindo, going down the list, Lloyd, that's when he chose August as his writer. August originally gave Lloyd Jitney, the one we won the Tony on 2 years ago for Best Revival. Lloyd rejected Jitney twice. And August said to himself, that means I got to write a better play. I got to be a better writer. You keep rejecting my same thing. So he wrote Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which was a huge opus. And with Lloyd's guidance and prodding and pushing and challenges, he cut it down to what we saw on Broadway. Now, which was extraordinary. That's when Rock Dutton got discovered, and he did something with Levy, no other person. Chad plays the same role, completely different, equally as brilliant. Completely different. But that was Rock Dutton, Joe Seneca, Robert Judd, Teresa Merritt, you know, and on and on. So now we look at it under new eyes at a new time, under George's direction, who wasn't an August Wilson crony like I am, but is a great director, under Denzel Washington, who loves August Wilson's work and has become his champion in producing these movies. So everybody had a lot at stake. My challenge was to take a 2-hour and 45-minute play, gorgeously written, years and years of honing it and taking that coal and making a diamond and making it a 90-minute movie without you missing anything that you remembered from the play.
That's a lot to cut out.
What's the challenge? How do you take all these arias that August loves to write and make them theatrical? Instead of telling a play where actors tell you where to look, make it a motion picture where pictures show you where to look, what you should be listening to. So what can I take from, and August's muscles are his words. So how do I keep it equally muscular with pictures?
I want to dive deeper into that point and how you as a writer shave, because that's so much of being a writer is cutting down. But it's Netflix. They just did The Irishman, which was like 5 hours long. You know, I think The Five Bloods was like 2+. Like, why does it have to be 90? Why couldn't it be 2 hours or 2.5?
That's the formula. That's the formula they're going to give a writer. It better not be over 119 pages or we're not reading it. I've been a writer a long time. Lackawanna Blues came out in 2005. I hadn't made another movie since then because I was getting so many black people behind the camera. You know, they were like, you had never make another movie. You're fucking... So I didn't make one. And they were honest. I didn't make one. Till Ma Rainey. So the thing is, you want to make it a motion picture. So August's muscles are his language. So how do I keep the most muscular part of his language, but yet don't get, you know, balance it with the visuals that make us not miss what I have to take out? You know, so you dig what I'm saying? So it's like, how, because the thing about August, you will be flawed if you don't keep the music of his writing going. If you stop, start, you're going to kill it. So it's got to be the connectivity, the tissue, the connecting tissue must stay there no matter what else you cut. So sometime I will cut something and Denzel will say, man, I think you might throw the rhythm off if you cut that. I said, no, let me read it to you. Because, it, you know, he said, but there was four people in that scene. I said, yeah, but it's going to be now two and they're going to keep the rhythm. Let me show you. And I would read it. And Denzel knows the work in and out too. And he would say, yeah. And I would say, no, don't you read. Let me read the whole thing. You know, and I would read each character. And I would say, see how it flows? And he would say, yeah, not, but bring this little piece back and see if it still flows. And I'd bring that back. And, you know, but when I handed it in at 119, they told me, no, now we need it at 110. Now we need it at 100. And I finally settled on like 96 pages. I said, I can't cut it. You will never see a black, well, yeah, I'm going to tell it. You're not going to see a 5-hour black play, movie. You know, they did Roots and then they did Roots again instead of doing the Harlem Renaissance. So, you know, because I've been pitching Harlem Renaissance for 10 years. Let's do 5 parts of the Harlem Renaissance, 5 2-hour movies. But yet they'll do Band of Brothers. But they will not invest in our work. And that's why we have to invest in our work. If we want to see the Harlem Renaissance 5 2-part movies, come on, y'all got billions of dollars. Don't make me call names. They know, you know, they listen to your show. They know who I'm talking to. I'm willing to put it together. 5 2-hour movies. I can't write them all. I'll bring the team. We'll write our ass off. We keep waiting for other people to say, okay, and give us permission to tell our stories. And they will tell us what the rules are. Mm. When are we going to make the rules?
In those 96 pages, what is your Ma Rainey's Black Bottom about?
Well, it's about how the brilliance of who we are, more than that, the power of who we are as a people gets compromised when we sell it and allow other people to put reins on it. Ma, you know, and that's the metaphor of the entire movie. Ma Rainey was the most powerful singer in the world in a tent. And she became a very wealthy woman in tents all through the South. Once she gave her voice to these white men in the studio to put it in this machine and control how high, how low, how long she could sing for a certain amount of money they gave her, she lost her power because she could make people cry in the tent, forget all their troubles, get sanctified by the blues and just, you know, just, oh my God, you just saved my life. But she couldn't do that in the studio. She never did it on record. Out of her 200 or 300 records she recorded, she never was as big a recording star as Bessie or any, you know, any singer. But in the tent, no one could touch her. No one. With her dancers, even from the jug band to the, when she got the big band, with the, not the big band, but the larger band with the dancers, nobody could touch Ma Rainey in the tent. When black dollars went from black hands to black hands.
For more from me and Ruben, join us over at patreon.com/Touré Show. Thanks so much to Ruben for a great interview. And thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Keena Murphy, and Earl Dorsey. Touré Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Touré and on Instagram at Touré Show. And check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Touré Show. Touré Show is written by me, Touré, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shonda Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we'll be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.